A warning to our listeners. This episode contains descriptions of a crime scene that some might find disturbing.
Previously, on Looking for the Tote Family.
I'm wondering if somebody can do a wellness check on my brother.
We have a family that bounces back and forth between Connecticut and Florida.
They've been really sick for probably like the past week and a half. And I can't seem to get a hold of them.
I have on social media, I've just sort of seen that people have not seen or heard of from this family in a long, long time.
Their neighbor is concerned about them in Florida, so they reported them as missing.
They are renting a place. They're actually being evicted from that property.
The kids have not been seen since Thanksgiving.
There's actually been more development.
From the day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Sten Spinella.
And I'm Taylor Hartz.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family.
My sister-in-law was making a comment about basically the world ending on the 28th, and nobody has talked to them.
So they think the world is ending, and you're worried they're going to, like...
In our first episode, we heard four calls to the Osceola County Sheriff's Department looking for Tony Tote, his wife Megan, and their children, 13-year-old Alec, 11-year-old Tyler, and 4-year-old Zoe.
Osceola County Sheriff's Office, you're on a recorded line. How can I help you?
Police received a fifth call on January 9th from the FBI.
Hey, how's it going? My name's Casey Hatcher. I'm with FBI of the New Haven Division.
Federal agents were investigating Tony's physical therapy practices. The allegations we first heard were that Tony was committing some sort of healthcare fraud.
I have a case up here, an investigation up here. My subject is down there.
Federal agents executed a search warrant at his office, and Tony was aware that he was under investigation and actually was in contact with them in November, late November. And he told them that he was going to go to Florida to settle some things and then come back and, you know, submit to an interview and whatever they wanted to do. But then he didn't come back to Connecticut.
Maybe if I could just talk to someone regarding a person that they did welfare check on back on the in December, I believe, possibly the 29th.
I think investigators and reporters were dealing with a similar task. We were both working on a case that was happening in Florida, but was also happening in Connecticut.
Okay, what was the address that they went to?
The address they went to was 202 Reserve Place in Celebration, Florida.
We were trying to figure out who the Totes were in Colchester, how they ended up in Celebration, and what was happening down there.
I see the call here. I don't see that they wrote any report on it or anything. Let me see if they made any comments.
Investigators were doing the same thing.
Okay.
They were investigating the healthcare fraud in Connecticut, looking into Tony's businesses, and they were in Florida trying to find him.
Oh, nothing was documented.
Okay.
4 days later, on the morning of January 13th, federal agents were outside Tony's rental home in Celebration. They were looking to apprehend him after a months-long investigation into his physical therapy practice.
I'm a special agent with the Department of Health and Human Services, and your agency has gone out to do a welfare check several times at 202 Reserve Place and 211 Longview Avenue.
He had allegedly been defrauding private insurance companies as well as the government through Medicaid, saying that he was having these appointments with people, sometimes for years after they had stopped seeing him.
Because we have an arrest warrant for the target that resides there, and our agents have eyes on our target right now.
And they saw him outside of his house, which is weird now that I think about it, because nobody had seen this guy in so long, and he's just chilling on his porch.
We were hoping to execute the arrest warrant,
okay.
And we were hoping that we could have two deputies meet us out there.
The person leading this, Melissa O'Neill, called the Osceola County Sheriff's Office asking for backup.
We just need assistance just to have some marked units there. We're not sure if there's children in the house. He does have three children. His wife should be there, but that's an unknown.
The sheriff's office came to help, and at this point, it was the third time they'd come to the home after two earlier well-being checks that turned up nothing.
Has he made any threats towards the children or the wife that you know of?
There's concerns there. I don't know of any direct threats, but there are concerns. He does know that he is being investigated. We have executed a search warrant.
Okay.
As far as we know, he's tapped out all his finances. Resources, and he has not contacted his family in over a week.
They go inside, you know, telling Tony that he's under arrest. And they find a lot more than what they bargained for.
Case number 20I004299202 Reserve Place.
Later that morning, Health and Human Services agents Melissa O'Neill, Jim Wynn, and Mike Phelps told detectives what they saw.
Date is January 13th, 2020. Time is 10:56 in the morning. Persons present: Detective Miller, Detective Quinn, and
Melissa O'Neill.
Melissa O'Neill, what's your title and who do you work for?
I'm a special agent with the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Inspector General.
O'Neill told detectives that they didn't expect to walk into that house that day and find what they found. They expected to arrest a physical therapist for healthcare fraud.
All right, Melissa, well, obviously we were informed that there are some family members inside of a home at 202, deceased. You want to tell us what led us up to this?
Sure. We received last week, either Thursday or Friday, I can check my paperwork, we received what we call an OI-43. It's an assist to help our Boston regional office. Agents out of Connecticut had a case on this gentleman, and they received a complaint arrest warrant signed by the judge on Friday.
So they're there early in the morning surveilling the house that the Totes rent at 202 Reserve Place, as well as the condo they own at 211 Longview Ave.
So the plan was we were going to do some surveillance, get some info, take our photos. We were going to rally with the two guys coming down from Connecticut, go to the school, see if we could find any information about where this family was, because nobody had heard from them. Nobody could locate them. I know you guys have been out here several times doing welfare checks. Yeah. So we were trying to serve the arrest warrant.
Okay.
Jim got eyes on him. He was sitting about here. Jim, 7:45-ish, saw him come out of the house.
The father?
Yes.
I came here to do surveillance on the house. 202 Reserve Place. And I sat pretty much, various spaces around this area. Started doing surveillance. Didn't see anything. Like, the house was completely pitch black. All the blinds, all the shutters were shut. Kept on moving the vehicles. I went to the backside, did a quick drive through all the shutters, and the lights were off on the backside as well. So I, then I sat here, the last place I parked at, and I gave myself till 9 a.m. I was like, if I don't see him, I don't see anything. I pretty much suspected that nobody lives there.
They're just conducting surveillance. They didn't actually think they were going to see anything.
Approximately 7:45, I saw the guy get out of the house and sit on his front porch. And I was like, I was shocked because I wasn't expecting anyone at the home.
Jim, 7:45-ish, saw him come out of the house.
The father?
Yes. And the gentleman looked over at Jim.
He, from the porch, he looks directly at me where we're sitting right now. And he just, you know, and usually what I do is I'll, take a snapshot, zoom in, mm-hmm. send it to my coworkers just to confirm. Then I call my coworker, my buddy Mike.
Because Jim thought he was made, he wanted me to get eyes on. So Jim took off and parked somewhere, I think, behind his house. Mm-hmm. And I just came here, drove, slow roll in front of his house and got eyes on. And
do you remember what he was wearing?
He had just a dark colored shirt, maybe dark blue. That was all I recall. Okay. And then, I got a pretty good look at his face and was like, yeah, that's the guy in our photos.
Okay.
So then I set up shop right across here, right across the park, and just watched him for another 5-10 minutes as he sat out there. He then, I watched him get up, and we were actually talking, Jim, Melissa, and I, about, hey, let's just go grab him right now at the front of the door. And, but then I let him know. He got up and kind of like very shakily, like, walked back into his house. Like, he was, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it besides like a waddle, and he was kind of convulsing a little bit, kind of shaking. It was odd.
We called our supervisor. Our supervisor said, let's just hook him up. The plan was, if he was still on the front porch, the three of us were just going to grab him because he was already out front. Once he went back inside, we called you guys, saw if we could get two marked units out. Just, we didn't know if the kids would be home alone. You know, then we would have a DCS problem, all that stuff.
So Melissa O'Neill called asking for a couple extra officers to come in while they try and execute this warrant. And then the combination of these federal agents who are just there for healthcare fraud and the Osceola County Sheriff's Office officers went in there.
The Totes' house is just a few feet from neighbors on each side, yet no one heard anything or suspected that anything had happened there until this turned into a much larger investigation.
We knocked on the door, announced police that we had an arrest warrant for Tony. No one came. We knocked again, announced police, arrest warrant for Tony, come to the door, open it. 30, 45 seconds, no one came, and we physically saw him go into the house. So that's, we decided it's time to go in and get him.
Mike tried the door. The door was unlocked, so he popped it open. Still did the initial, as we did before we popped the door, police, arrest warrant. We could hear some mumbling from, like, inside the house. It sounded like it was up from upstairs, so we slowly made our way in. He was at the top of the stairs, still mumbling, needing a lot of assistance to get down. He said, don't touch him because he will fall. He was struggling, and it took him a while to get down the stairs, but we, like, waited slowly while he just took it stair by stair. Once he got towards the bottom, we asked him where Megan and the children were. He said Megan was upstairs sleeping, and he also, like, called for her.
Like she was alive.
We asked where the children were, and he said, oh, I don't know. I can't remember if they went to a sleepover last night.
So I stayed with him, and Melissa and a couple of sheriffs went upstairs.
The master bedroom door was open, and you could see there's a master, the bed up against the right wall. And there were two mattresses on the floor and at the foot of the bed, and you could see feet that were, it was pulled. You could tell it was somebody that was deceased.
That's when they notified that there were a couple of sevens, which the sheriff notified me was deceased bodies. Yeah.
Investigators said that the feet they could see at the foot of the bed, Megan's feet, were visibly decomposed and discolored. On the mattress that was laid out below the bed, there were two more bundles of blankets. Inside those blankets were the bodies of Alec and Tyler.
That's when one of your deputies said we had some sevens up here. He went and checked and found Megan under a blanket. We couldn't find the daughter. So we went to the balcony, the top of the stairs. We're like, Tony, where's Zoe? Oh, isn't she in her bed sleeping?
They busted in the one door that was locked. Said they couldn't find the daughter. So asked him again, and he was just kind of mumbling, didn't really tell us anything. Then they came back downstairs, and we handcuffed him.
And I walked back out and I said, Tony, where is Zoe? And he was confused.
Because we couldn't find the daughter. He said, all right, like let's look in the freezers, look for that. So we looked in the freezers and fridge up there, nothing. Came back into the house, entered through the back, looked into the freezer and fridge downstairs, and nothing, just a bunch of rotten food.
And that's when we went back in the master bedroom, and she's so little, she's only like 3 or 4. There was another little blanket at the foot of the bed. So like, if these are where the pillows are at the top of the bed, Megan was on the right side of the bed, like normally, and Zoe's right here at the foot of the bed, laying across the bed.
So underneath blankets?
Underneath blankets. We pulled back and you could see, like, from where I was standing, you could see the hair, her hair.
Zoe was wrapped in a blanket, laid at her mother's feet on the bed. She was only 4 years old. She was small. And because her body was small and because she was so young, she was significantly more decomposed than her siblings and her mother. So according to reports, there really wasn't too much left wrapped in that blanket, which we hear in the recordings was a difficult thing for the investigators to see. Most of them mentioned that they had children, that they were parents, that seeing a four-year-old girl decomposed laying at her mother's feet was a horrific, challenging sight for them. And I know as a reporter, that was one of the most difficult things for me to read and report on. Especially after seeing in the course of our reporting photos and videos of Zoe, of hearing her voice, hearing her laugh, watching videos where she's playing with her father, to just know that she was not only dead, not only murdered, but literally left to rot.
So someone said they had seen her up there and we missed her when we were looking the first time. Didn't see her.
I was moved at the end of the interviews with the agents in the sheriff's office, where the sheriff's office asked the agents if they were okay. And, you know, one of the guys basically said yes, but he repeated himself a bunch of times.
You all right? You okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah. So just not what I was
expecting
on the day.
Exactly. You know? I imagine. Yeah, that's what anybody was expecting this outcome. So.
Yeah.
The way Phelps kept saying yeah, it sounded like he was trying to convince himself that he was okay, or like he was trying to put on a brave face. And then with Melissa O'Neill.
You okay?
Yeah. Right. I have a 2 and 4 year old.
Yeah. We're dads.
She said she was all right too. But in saying that she was all right, she mentioned her 2 and 4 year old. I mean, none of them were all right.
We went back downstairs. We got him outside of the house. He's on his way out. He said he was taking some Benadryl. He had taken some Benadryl.
Did he say anything? Did you hear him?
Just mumbling. Just mumbling a bunch of stuff. Just, you know, he was falling over. Like, you know.
Can I wasn't he stand sure on his own?
To me, it seemed like he was kind of, you know, being dramatic.
After Megan and the kids' bodies were found in the bedroom, Tony was taken into custody. He told investigators that he had just taken Benadryl in an attempt to commit suicide, so he was taken straight to a hospital.
But we didn't find out about that until a press conference 2 days later.
Good afternoon, and I want to thank everybody for coming to the sheriff's office today. I'm Osceola County Sheriff Russ Gibson, and I wanted to give you the latest update on the death investigation that occurred at 202 Reserve Place in Celebration.
A lot of reporters were in the room to listen to Gibson and ask him questions. But Taylor and I watched it together in the day's newsroom on a local news station's live stream.
I just want you to keep in mind that this is still very much an active investigation, and I'm going to attempt to answer your questions at the end of this. But there are still some things that I won't be able to divulge at this time. On January 13th, 2020, Osceola County Sheriff's deputies responded to 2002 Reserve Place in Celebration to assist federal agents from the Department of Health and Human Services in serving a federal arrest warrant for Anthony Toad. Anthony Toad's date of birth is September 29th, 1975. Deputies made contact with Anthony in the home along with federal agents and he was immediately detained. A safety check of the home was conducted where deputies discovered 4 deceased individuals inside. The home was immediately secured and a search warrant was obtained by our detectives.
This press conference was the first time we got confirmed, concrete information about this case and the fact that Tony Toad was allegedly involved. We had read some rumors on Twitter that Tony had been arrested, but until then, they were just rumors.
Detectives and forensic investigators began their investigation and crime scene processing. The medical examiner's office also responded to the scene, and an autopsy was done the following day. The reports of the autopsy determined that the cause of death of the 4 decedents inside the home to be homicide. Anthony has cooperated with the investigation and he He has confessed to killing his wife, Megan Tote, 42 years of age, whose date of birth is January 28, 1977, and their three children. Alec Tote, 13 years of age, born September 26, 2006. Tyler Tote, 11 years of age, born December 30th, 2008. And Zoe Tote, who was 4 years of age, born July 23rd, 2015. Anthony also killed their family dog, Breezy.
We're in January now, more than a year later, and we still haven't heard anything new from police, which is frustrating. We have gotten some new information from the state's attorney's office, but the sheriff's office has told us they're tight-lipped about this because they don't want to jeopardize the outcome of Tony's court proceedings.
In every document that we've received from the state's attorney's office and the sheriff's office, Tony's confession has been redacted. Until recently, months into the investigation, that alleged confession was the only thing we had from Tony, the only example of his voice or his account of what happened. And the media still has not been able to see that, almost a year later. All we know is that he allegedly confessed at the hospital while under suicide watch.
As sheriff of Osceola County, it brings me great sadness to report, you know, such a tragedy. And we grieve along with the victim's family and friends, along with the community, for this tragic loss of innocent lives.
He absolutely recognized the gravity of the moment and treated it with humanity in the press conference. And I know Taylor and I were pretty impressed by his breaking down in the middle of him delivering this. And I think other police officers were impressed.
I applaud him. I've been working in this job for 23 years. And this job changes your personality.
We spoke to Fred Hinderman, who's the Osceola County Sheriff Department's public information officer at their headquarters in Kissimmee.
Makes you very callous. It makes us think that everyone's bad. He's been able to keep his humanity, and it's a breath of fresh air to be able to see him, to be able to show emotion. And you know, some people were very critical over that. I think that we as a culture in law enforcement, we've developed this culture of not showing emotion, not be able to be emotional. And when one of us becomes emotional anytime, we get criticized. I think the community as a whole needs to see that we're human, needs to see that these crimes do affect us as law enforcement. And it does affect the sheriff. I mean, he is very, very emotional person when it comes to when we have a tragedy like this. It really does hit him.
And I guess we know this to be true from pop culture, that isn't something that police officers usually do. You know, cry in general, but also in front of the media. And that usually, you know, they make dark jokes about things like this. And I'm sure they have about this. But at that moment, he, I guess, couldn't help himself. And I think a lot of people identified with, you know, when and why he cried, because he's listing the ages of these kids and then he gets to Zoe and he has to stop and collect himself before he can say the year she was born.
And Zoe Tote, who was 4 years of age, born July
23rd, 2015. Like Sten said, I think law enforcement officials are similar to reporters in that we compartmentalize. We turn off our own personal emotions in order to get our job done. And we're desensitized. We write about crimes and read about murders almost every day. You have to turn that emotion off. You have to remove that personal connection or these jobs will break you. And I think that this was a case that was starting to seep through those cracks and really get into our heads. Cases like this make you question humanity and make you question how much evil there is in the world. And as we're trying to wrap our heads around that, seeing the sheriff let his emotions through in that way made it really real.
Myself, I cannot understand what would cause a person to commit such evil and horrendous acts. But I can say that if there's any one person or any family out there that's going through a crisis or a difficult situation, there's help out there for you.
There was a lot of reaction on social media after those details were released. There were a lot of people asking things like, what about the dog? Why did he have to kill the dog too? poor Breezy. People were really stuck on the dog, myself included. It just hits people in a different way. I think movies and TV can kind of desensitize us to the death of humans, but it's pretty few and far between that you see an animal murdered. So I think that really struck a chord with a lot of people. People on social media seem to be happy with the severity of the charges levied against Tony. 4 counts of first-degree homicide, and 1 count of animal cruelty. I think there was some frustration amongst journalists and other people who were following this case and trying to figure out what happened, like the social media detectives, because we didn't get much information from that press conference. We did get confirmation that Tony had been charged. We now knew who was dead, we knew their names, we knew their ages, but investigators couldn't even tell us when these people died or how they were killed. Information that you'd expect to get from a press conference like that. A confirmation of if they were shot, if they were stabbed, if they were poisoned, and a date of death. But we weren't given any indication of how or when this family was murdered, and it was months before we got that information. It was a couple very long months waiting to find out what happened to them. It's now been over a year since the family was found dead, and we still don't know what day they died. In the days that I had known the name Tony Tote, I had scoured social media and Google, uncovering every ounce of information I could get about him and every photo I could find. In every photo I saw of Tony, he looked like a normal, healthy, handsome guy. There were photos of him embracing his children, hugging his dog, dancing with Megan when they were in high school, pictures of them on vacation and out on walks. He really just looked happy. The first time I saw Tony Tote after the murders was when he was let out for a perp walk in Florida, and it didn't even look like the same person.
Confess to killing your family. Can you tell us why?
Sten and I watched a live stream from our newsroom here in Connecticut as Tony was led toward a patrol car by 2 men from the sheriff's department.
Why are deputies saying that you did this?
He was handcuffed, wearing an all-white jumpsuit and yellow hospital socks, as he walked stoically toward the parking lot and into a car with bars on the windows.
Did you love your family? Did you kill your family?
The family that you killed.
I was interested in knowing what he looked like and didn't expect him to answer any questions or anything. I mean...
Your youngest was only 3?
Perp walks in general are sort of confusing to me. Like, just arrest the guy. Why does he need to be walked in front of the media? But, I mean, I was surprised by how rotund he was.
Tony had gained a significant amount of weight and really looked nothing like the photos that I saw.
He sort of looked like a ghost. He sort of looked out of it. He wasn't making, you know, eye contact with anybody.
If I had seen that man on the street after staring at photos of Tony Tote for 3 days straight, I would have walked right by him and not recognized him.
Tony, give us an explanation, Tony.
Are you sad about this?
He was being really surrounded and flooded by reporters and photographers.
You kill your family.
Telling people you couldn't have done this.
You know, I've been in journalism my entire career, and I always get so frustrated when I see how reporters are portrayed in television shows and movies, because I've covered murders, I've covered crimes, I've covered Capitol Hill, and I've never seen the press behave the way they show on television and in the movies. Getting in someone's face with a camera or a microphone and shouting questions at them. But that's what this perp walk was like. There were reporters shouting questions from every direction, getting as close as they could to Tony, shoving microphones in his face. There were flashes going off. And there was one reporter who kept shouting, "What about Breezy?
What about the dog? What about Breezy?"
Which was a question that had echoed over social media and the Facebook pages regarding the case in the past few days.
It seemed ridiculous to me that, you know, the reporter had 45 seconds to ask Tony a question, and the best they could come up with was, "What about Breezy?"
And, you know, it was an important question because it's one that people were asking, but it's also a pretty trivial question in light of the fact that 4 human beings had just been killed.
These reporters are shouting questions at him.
Say something.
And they can't have thought these questions were going to be answered. I mean, some of them were just like
Tony, do you love your family?
Extremely insensitive, but...
You proud of yourself?
They did say, you know...
Are you sad?
Do you have any remorse? And I was hoping that he would answer that.
Do you have any remorse?
And they kind of seemed to take him not saying whether he had remorse as him not having remorse.
Why? It's your last chance.
The other thing that struck me was when people were saying, this is your last chance. This is your last chance to talk. Like... In reality, you probably would get another chance to talk, but they kind of have a point because it's possible that he will never be free, like walk free again in this world. So like that felt kind of poignant to me.
I think what stood out to me most was that everyone I'd talked to loved Tony so much. They said he was such a doting father and an attentive soccer coach, a kind man with a warm heart. Everybody liked him. Everybody loved him. In all his photos, he was beaming and smiling. And this person that walked out looked like they were dead too. Like there was nothing behind his eyes. There was no emotion. There were reporters screaming in his face. Like that alone should have caused some type of anxiety or agitation or reaction. But there were no signs of life from him. He was just walking and looking straight ahead. It wasn't what I expected. I expected a remorseful man who looked like his entire family had just been ripped from his life, who was apologetic. I expected him to be crying. I didn't expect him to speak to the media, but I expected him to look like he was exhausted, distraught, heartbroken, emotional, and I saw none of that. It was months before we received the autopsy reports explaining how the Tote family died. As we waited, I continually pestered Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Joshua Stephanie. I probably called his office more times than his secretary would have liked, but I eventually got Dr. Stephanie on the phone. The first question I had for him was, when were they killed? We still didn't know. The sheriff's office was saying it could have been days or it could have been a month. This phone call with Dr. Stephanie was the first time I heard confirmation that the family had been dead for at least 2 weeks, based on their level of decomposition. Although I expected that, and I'd heard that theory that it had probably been 2 weeks that Tony had been living in that house with them, it still put a pit in my stomach. It's just hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine the smell, the sight. I asked Dr. Stephanie to describe the state of a body when it's 2 weeks into decomposing. A question that, quite frankly, I wish I hadn't asked. Because it took a long time to get the visual of those bodies in that state out of my head. It's something that probably crosses my mind every day and always bothers me, always makes me nauseous. The medical examiner went into graphic detail about how a body decomposes, but we'll spare you the gruesome description. I think one of the things that got to me the most about this conversation with Dr. Stephanie was that when the autopsy reports were finally released, we learned that Megan, Tyler, and Alec had been stabbed, but there was no noting of a stab wound on Zoe. When this news came out, people on social media, and to be honest, me and my colleagues in the newsroom were saying, oh, thank God, she wasn't stabbed. Maybe she just fell asleep without knowing she wouldn't wake up, and that's the one bit of mercy we can have in this story. But when I spoke with Dr. Stephanie again, he told me that just because there weren't any stab wounds visible on Zoe's body doesn't mean that she wasn't stabbed too. Because she was so little, her body was so decomposed that they couldn't even tell. And that got to me. It still gets to me. Imagining this little girl that I can picture from the dozens of photos I've stared at, with her bouncing curls and bright eyes, wrapped in a blanket at her mother's feet, so decomposed that medical experts couldn't even figure out what happened to her. I think it would make any person sick.
We learned that the cause of death was some combination of Benadryl and stabbing. We were just so confused because the stab wounds were small. I reached out to a doctor at a local hospital, and he said Benadryl, unless taken in copious amounts, doesn't necessarily kill you.
The houses neighboring the Totes are only a few feet away, but but no one heard the screams that you'd assume would come from a conscious person being stabbed. That, combined with the levels of Benadryl in their system, led us to believe that the family was probably drugged and then stabbed after they were unconscious. But we still don't know for sure. What we do know is that there was an empty bottle and two empty boxes of store brand Benadryl from Walgreens found in the tote's trash. There were two small hunting knives with 5 to 6 inch blades found at the crime scene. One was covered in blood. Megan, Tyler, and Alec were all stabbed in their stomachs. Megan's wound was the deepest, sinking 8 inches into her body at a downward angle. The autopsy found that she was likely stabbed a second time right before she died. Alec and Tyler's stab wounds were smaller, just a few inches. But a blade went deep enough to hit and injure one of Alec's ribs. Authorities have never said with certainty whether it was the Benadryl or the stabbing that ultimately killed the family. The official ruling from the ME's office was that the Totes died from homicidal violence of unspecified means in association with diphenhydramine toxicity. We received hundreds of crime scene photos, and the photos of the bedrooms where the bodies were found show us a lot. The bedroom was messy and cluttered, with piles of things on the floor and nightstand and bed. There are so many little things and clues that we can zoom in on and pick apart and analyze.
Crime scene photos showed a mattress on the floor soaked in blood, black zip ties, blood-smeared first aid sprays, a handgun, and a red restraint.
One of the most startling things that we see in the crime scene photos is that in the bedroom where the bodies were found, there was some sort of strap or restraint tied around one of the bedposts. It's bright red and almost looks like a dog leash or the kind of strap that you'd use to tie your kayak to the top of your car. It's secured to the head of the bed and then kind of tied around itself in a web of knots. There are blankets and stuffed animals strewn all across the floor, across the bed and the mattress that was on the floor. The nightstand next to the bed, right next to where the strap is tied up, is piled high with notes and photos and a check and a couple other pieces of paper. There's a soccer ball on the bed. There's a stuffed pink bunny on the floor by the bed.
What was especially jarring, at least to me, was a teddy bear could be seen near the foot of the bed where Zoe's body was found.
There's a sort of shrine, for lack of a better word, at the foot of the bed. There's a teddy bear, some little dolls, a cross, a USA soccer scarf, a picture of a cat, a framed photo of the kids with Elmo and Cookie Monster, and a printed prayer or poem titled Why God Made Little Boys.
The gun in the photos looked like a real handgun, but it's actually a Daisy brand BB gun. There's also a picture of a December 18th receipt of Tony's from Academy Sports and Outdoors, a sporting goods store about 17 minutes away from their place in Celebration. He bought peanut M&Ms, a Gatorade, a StrikePoint 600 FPS pellet gun, and a packet of air gun ammunition. The pellet gun is not seen in any of the crime scene photos. According to an expert we talked to, depending on where it's aimed, such as a shot to vital areas, this pellet gun can cause serious injury or death. So we have this receipt for a pellet gun, this photo of a BB gun, and it's confusing. It's another complicating detail in this puzzle. Police and prosecutors haven't said anything about these guns, so we're not sure if these details are actually important.
There were several zip ties found around the bedroom. It wasn't specified where exactly they were found, whether they were cut off of a body or if they were found untied, but the evidence photos show a lot of zip ties. There's also a bottle of first aid spray that says on the bottle that it prevents infection and relieves pain, and it is smeared with dried, bloody fingerprints.
We have the bottles of Benadryl and the knives, which likely explain the cause of death. But the gun throws a wrench into what we're trying to understand. We still don't get how it happened. There's still no picture of what happened minute by minute that night. We just have these spare parts we don't really know what to do with. Sure, the peanut M&Ms and Gatorade that we mentioned probably don't matter, but as long as we're missing answers, every detail matters. We have these puzzle pieces that may fit together, but we don't know what the puzzle looks like. I hope the trial will explain these details from the crime scene photos. Maybe a prosecutor will be able to piece together the puzzle. Rather than giving us answers, the crime scene photos throw into stark reality the nature of this crime that no vigil or other healing mechanism can ever truly overcome.
One thing that we didn't learn from the crime scene photos was what happened to Breezy. We didn't know how Breezy had died or where the dog's body was. I spoke with medical examiner Dr. Joshua Stephanie in January, and he told me that Breezy had been stabbed multiple times, which was just awful to hear. I'd never had to investigate a dog's death before, so I wasn't sure where the body would be. Would it go to animal control? Dr. Stephanie told me that Breezy was at the medical examiner's office too, with the rest of the family, waiting to be examined.
Anthony has been arrested on a warrant obtained by our detectives today for multiple counts of homicide and one count of felony animal cruelty.
When we were listening to Russ Gibson's press conference.
We're still waiting on positive identification of the four deceased persons recovered in the home by the medical examiner's office.
That was the day that we were first able to confirm that Tony was accused of killing his wife and his children and their dog. It was the first time we heard their names spoken out loud, and the first of many times I would write their names.
But based on our investigation and the suspect's statements, we strongly believe that they are that of Megan, Alec, Tyler, and Zoe. Based on the initial investigation to include the suspect's statements, the deaths have been determined to have occurred sometime towards the end of December.
But I remember listening to that press conference.
With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
And hearing a reporter ask when the murders took place.
Sheriff, you said that your deputies went there on December 29th at the request of the family to check on the Todds. Do you believe that Megan and the kids were already killed by then, already dead by then?
Well, according to our investigation, according to his statements, it was sometimes towards the end of December that he said that he had killed his family.
And I remember just looking at Sten and being like, he's been in this house with them the whole time.
Who knows when Tony would have been apprehended and the bodies would have been found if not for this healthcare fraud investigation. It's so weird to think that a false claims investigation could turn into a quadruple homicide, quintuple if you include Breezy.
Our hearts go out to the family and friends of these decedents. You know, three children and a mother has lost their lives at the hands of a husband and supposed father and their dog. This is despicable and cannot be tolerated anywhere in the United States of America, let alone Osceola County, Florida. And that's why we will work tirelessly and have. Our teams are dedicated to the safety and security of the residents of Osceola County, and we will do that because it is a calling that we receive, we believe, from the good Lord above, to make sure that these people, when they decide to commit these heinous acts, are held accountable.
To see the crime scene photos and to view the full autopsy reports, visit our website, lookingforthetotefamily.com.
Next time on Looking for the Tote Family.
I feel a little different. I mean, no one's, you can't make sense of it.
They're just both loving, devoted parents. They appear to have the perfect family.
He was her first everything, like her first boyfriend, her first serious relationship.
Everything she ever posted online suggested nothing but she was like the best mom.
To see him and to know him, you wouldn't think that there would be a mean bone in his body whatsoever.
None of this makes sense. And you just want to know why.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. Inizaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.